Hello and welcome to Filibustering History, a podcast series where we discuss what historians do with their lives. I am Rob Denning, lead faculty for the history programs at Southern New Hampshire University's College of Online and Continuing Education. If we are looking at a map where north is up and south is down, then to my left, on that map anyway, is James Fennessy, the Associate Dean of Faculty for History at SNHU. To my right, on that map, is Jeffrey Henry, a recent graduate of the MA program in Public History at SNHU, who is currently involved with numerous projects at a bunch of New England museums and with the American Antiquarian Society. Today we are going to talk about his background, the various jobs he has performed at museums and other public history institutions, and the importance of networking, which is not something we often hear about much in history podcasts, but we need to talk about it a bit anyway. What is your name and what do you do?
So I'm Jeff Henry. I'm a museum guy. I work at three different places now. One's volunteer, the Westford Historical Society. The other one's Fruitlands Museum over in Worcester, Mass. And the most recent one is at the American Antiquarian Society, where I'm digitizing a bunch of old periodicals.
So Jeff, can you tell us a little bit about your background? How does one prepare for life as a museum guy?
Well,
and what is that?
Museum professional is what LinkedIn says. So I actually started with archaeology. My undergrad's in anthropology, so I kind of have a mixed start there. And what really helps a lot is finding the local historical society. They always got something for you to do, and they kind of seduced me over to the museum field, and eventually, I found the public history degree at SNHU.
We've actually interviewed a couple of people that are in charge of historical societies, and they seem to be a great place to not only work, but also to gain some inspiration. So could you talk a little bit about that connection?
Like I said, historical societies, they're always a little smaller, and they always have something for you to do. And the kind of experiences you can get there, pretty much everything. You wear every hat, and the smaller the organization, you have to. So they really use you. They learn what you can do. If you can do a little IT, they'll give you a little IT work. If they know you can work with collections, they have you work with collections and so forth. It was a really good start. I'm still kind of working over there.
So you started off with you were working with the Fruitlands Museum was the first one, right?
The order is really the Westford Historical Society, Fruitlands, and then American Antiquarian Society. And Fruitlands, in a lot of ways, was really may have been in some ways my first paid museum job. They had me do just working as a guide over there, bringing people around, talking about the various histories of the museum, which isn't really just about fruit. It's kind of misleading. And yeah, they have me do more. At least I have myself do more for them when I can.
And so what types of other things did you end up doing there?
And so I often I'm not just relating history, I'm also presenting history. I show off the atlatls, which is just, old-fashioned spear throwers, which always gets people interested. And mostly, plus my back with a archaeology background, they often have me do a lot of archaeology-related things when they can. And of course, my thesis project with SNHU worked with them a bit to create a public program that was like an exhibit forum, that talked a lot of Native American history of New England. It went into specifically on beadwork, basket making, that kind of thing, and a good portion of it eventually evolved into just an activity that's in the visitor center now at Fruitlands Museum. So that was interesting because even like the earliest idea of it was just to have this thing out there to help bring people into the history on their own, and it sort of just rounded back to that, which is pretty amazing.
So you've mentioned your history background, but also your program and your work as a student. Could you talk a little bit about that? I'm interested to hear how your experiences as a student really helped to inform what you're doing now, but also how your interest as a student came about from these various experiences that you've had.
Be competitive, getting a master's degree helps a lot. But yeah, what a lot of the main things I learned at SNHU is, really history researching itself in a lot of ways, because my back, an anthropology degree doesn't really dive into history the same way as a history degree would. So, I learned a lot about, how to really dive into the evolving methodology of history. And that's really helpful, especially in like a museum, because you get evolving methodologies in every case, in every form. As collections age, things just get stranger. Different collections managers, different directors. And so, you know, little things like that, you know, make it much easier to work in a museum environment.
Great. So you find that the history background is helpful for that. So, because the reason I ask is we sometimes see students who come into a public history program when really what they want to do is museum studies. And it's really difficult to explain the difference between the two. And then when they get into the history program itself and they find out that they're learning methodology, they're learning historiography, the various skills and things that they need to learn and apply that don't necessarily align with just learning strict historical facts or necessarily preparing them for a career in the museum, sometimes they're disappointed. So I was wondering, have you the history degree, not the museum studies degree, but have you come across any key differences, especially with colleagues or in the background that they have versus what you might have from your history degree?
Well, one interesting thing is, first of all, I kind of knew what I was getting into. This is a history degree, not museum studies, so it's going to be more than museums. But one interesting real difference I saw is a colleague of mine, if not just recently, will in the near future get a museum studies degree. And the real difference there is she doesn't have to do a big project or a major thesis kind of thing that I had to do. And so that's a real difference. But the best part about, having to do some kind of thesis, some kind of project, is you can just kind of almost do what you want, at least, within the confines of the program. But, when you get that extra thing, I was able to say, okay, I'm going to bring together what I've learned so far before, during, and maybe even after. So that was a real difference. Masters in history, even if it's specifically toward public history, you get more. And so that's, certainly something you'd have to expect, but if that's what you want, that works great.
After you receive that degree, do you find that at least in the museums that you work with or the experiences you've had so far, do they tend to direct the people with history degrees into some jobs and then the people with museum studies degrees into different jobs? Or do they even really care? Is it just that you have an advanced degree, or do they actually try to kind of shuffle you based on the expertise you learned in your program?
It's a little hard to tell on that. I mean, because since I've already worked in museums, then I get the advanced degree, you're certainly going to, I'm sure I get looked at very differently in job applications now, which is, that's a whole other story, looking for jobs when you get there. But yeah, I mean, I'm sure at the very least, they certainly look at you differently. They see that, you've done more. And in my case, I have building experience already. So it all, for me, it gels together. Maybe not for other people that just want to completely change their careers.
That's an interesting point. So when people are first trying to get into this career, now you mentioned that you came into it, you had the anthropology degree before you started working for your first museum gig, or did that come, what order did that come in?
I got my anthropology degree in 2009, and just a year before that, I worked some volunteer work for the Westford Historical Society. But there was overlap between archaeology and history. I'd already done an archaeology field school by that point, so I did a bit of archaeology before I started to concentrate more on the history side of things. There's a lot of overlap. There's much more overlap than people realize, but not many people have done the shit that I did.
That actually brings up a point that comes up often in these interviews, is the importance of volunteer work. People tend to focus more on the paid jobs, obviously, because that's what we all want. But it does seem to be the case that, especially in public history, maybe not especially in public history, but it's very prevalent in public history that people get their foot in the door through volunteer work. And then a lot of times that will hopefully lead to some full-time employment. And it sounds like that's kind of the way it worked for you, too. You started off with volunteer work. And it sounds like do you still do some volunteer work? Are you mostly
when I can? I volunteer still when I can. I'm also a docent at Westford Historical Society. So every so often I work from there for a couple hours on a Sunday. presenting some Westford history. I got to come out of the shadows sometimes over there. Yeah, I mean, it's a slow process. It takes a lot of patience because it's a bit saturated. You know, New England can and may provide more opportunities in other parts of the country, but it's still, you know, it's still a lot of people, a lot of the same people with a lot of the same credentials you do. A lot of people look for people with master's degrees up here. So it takes a lot to be competitive, and the volunteer work does help a lot.
Did you find that that was like one of the defining experiences that really did help to set you apart? Or were there other things that you did that, you know, recommendations that you might have for other people going down the same line that, you know, obviously doing internships or volunteer work is important. But what else in your experience would you say really helped to set you apart to get you these roles?
You know, a lot of people have the same credentials as you may have. They're looking for the person that's a little overqualified. But in a lot of ways, what really helps in the end is, you know, knowing people. You know, I always felt it was kind of cliche, but it's kind of true. You know, it helped. Like two out of the three main archaeology gigs, well, actually pretty much all the archaeology jobs I had was because I knew someone and they had a contract. And the job I got at the American Antiquarian Society, the person they wanted, I worked with over at Fruitlands, and she couldn't fit it into her schedule the way they would have liked. So she presented it to me, and as a result, I was sort of almost an internal candidate. So yeah, a lot of patience, trying hard to build a real network beyond, like, you know, what LinkedIn may try to have you do. You know, connect with your professors, communicate with, you know, have a positive relationship with your colleagues where you work, and eventually, you know, you get things you're looking for.
So get out there and make connections, kids.
Yeah,
that's the key takeaway.
I always felt it was kind of a cliche for, and even now to a degree, kind of do, because, you know, your connections may be like, well, we were not looking for anyone anyway, and the museum may not be holding on to anyone's resumes, but still, every little bit, you know, and then eventually with a little patience, something will turn up.
Yeah, well, it's definitely true. I mean, it's not only for finding jobs and opportunities. It works for grad school as well. I mean, if you make strong connections with your instructors, I mean, obviously not simply for the opportunistic reason of finding something in the future, but because you're genuinely interested in the same things, you have similar personalities. It's a great opportunity to really find a mentor, to learn from people, but it also opens up these other avenues. So, you know, whether that's getting into a PhD program because somebody was connected and went to a certain place, or they know somebody there, or getting into a specific role at a museum or even another job. I think making those connections is important, and it's something that we do in an almost not dismissive way, but in an almost way where we're not thinking about it in social media and the online environment, because it's really easy to just connect and click and like, whereas making those strong connections traditionally, you actually got to know somebody, you put in time with phone calls and conversations. So making those strong connections really is important.
Yeah, LinkedIn is I find really good if you're in a more commercial field, but if you're in a more, you know, nonprofit field, you know, it's a little strange like that, because you always get this one random person that seems to be just in a competition to get more people. So yeah, it's much better to, the real connection in this case is a lot better. And I'm still plugged in with one of my old archaeology professors who over in Ireland now. And so it's an interesting connection to have. And, you know, she's still willing to look over some of the stuff I write, and she seems to like what I write. That's kind of nice.
Yeah, that's good. And one of the corollaries to all of this, of course, is that you have to have patience, because, you know, building a network of people, that's probably not going to pay off in the short run. You're going to have to wait, and eventually things will happen, but it can take time, especially when you're dealing with a network of people, and eventually something will come through, but it could take a while.
2008 was when I started working at the Westford Historical Society, and, you know, it's 2018 now, so these things are not instant.
Right. And so you mentioned a few minutes ago that you're now working for the American Antiquarian Society. So what are you doing with those guys?
Well, first of all, I'm basically paid through a contractor, but it's their collections. And so the main thing is I'm digitizing old periodicals from the late 19th century, mostly between like 1870s and a little bit into like maybe 1908 extension, how far it extends. So a lot of it's some interesting stuff, ads, you know, it's almost the grandfather of modern day clickbait on the internet. You know, some of them, especially later on, the ads get big and ridiculous, you know, and don't matter. And this is pre-FDA. So you get to see some pretty silly things like how acne is caused by your blood overheating, or how magnets will save your back problems.
You use cocaine to sleep or something. Yeah.
Yeah. It's kind of, yeah, that's not even an exaggeration. And they don't even say how this stuff works. But, you know, because I'm digitizing, it kind of goes by quickly. But luckily, the ads are kind of repetitive. So I can see these odd things showing up. And, the Spiritualist magazine, the Spiritualist one is really amusing, the Banner of Light, because, you know, they have the Spiritualist stuff. They're very much every kind of treatment they're all for, you know, even if it's not clear what that is. Clairvoyant, Dr. Bliss or something or other. Dr. Bliss was an actual person on there, which was amusing to see. I'm just started up with a women's journal now. It's an early women's lib journal, and it's literally called the Women's Journal pretty much. And it's, yes, a lot of the same kind of ads. I was surprised to see that kind of overlap. You know, the miracle cures for everything. You know, it'll cure your cataracts. It'll cure your constipation. It'll cure everything, and you'll feel great after. What's in it? I don't know. I don't know what swamp root is. I keep forgetting to look. You know, that's sort of a real saving grace of the project.
That's interesting because it almost shows, well, it does show how technology impacts the way that people present their products. So you have the traditional snake oil salesman who would go around in a cart presenting to people in the town square, or if you got kicked out of the town, you know, on the outskirts of town. And then you have print journalism where now they can print those images, and as you were saying, they get more prevalent and bigger. Then you have, when was it, the 90s, when restrictions were relaxed and regulations for pharmaceutical companies to be able to advertise were really pulled back. So you start seeing more advertisements on television, and now they're all over the internet as well. So just these various modes of technology that you have something that's as traditional as, you know, the snake oil salesman, and yeah. Now it's completely online.
It's really funny because I'm just reading the ads and there's not much of a difference between like the 1890 drug ad and the modern drug ad. It's really quite remarkable. You know, the only difference is the modern drug ad will admit that this drug might kill you in the end. That's the only difference. And it's true. That's exactly it, you know.
So how did you get connected with the American Antiquarian Society? How did you end up with this job?
This happened through a colleague of mine at the Fruitlands Museum. She had actually applied for that job some years ago with the guy I'm working with now over there, who's essentially my boss, or at least he relays the information of what we have to do. So, yeah, they basically gave her the job, but she couldn't fit it into her schedule, and she knew I was looking for something and kind of knew I could do something like that, and I kind of haven't. Digitization of history is a course. So, you know, she knew all that and contacted me. And, you know, then I applied and pretty much got it. I was actually a replacement for someone that transferred to another location with the contractor. So it was kind of a little bit of luck there. And, it'll be into the summer, but it's an interesting experience. You know, I get to work with some really delicate collections and variable quality of paper and things like that.
Could you talk a little bit about, you know, not too in depth, but if you don't want to, but a little bit about what that process is, because I'm guessing it has really expanded from the days of simply scanning and taking pictures of journals to the point where you're actually dealing with data mining and being able to intelligently search the text that you have so that we can pull out keywords.
I've technically done the whole process start to finish because I've worked at a historical site, but here I'm essentially a cog in the machine, the way it's set up. So I do the scanning and a little bit of quality control to make sure everything is right alignment, because they'll get grumpy if we don't do that. They could fix it, but they like us to fix that. And, you know, we make sure, you know, the image is coming out as well as it can, because this is variable. I've seen century-old coffee stains in these things. So we're kind of basically the ground floor for the way they set up the workflow here. And so, you know, we do our best to give them the best possible image we can give them. And it gets interesting, too, because, the quality of this material does vary a lot. And so we have to make little notes and say, this was so bad, you know, there's 90% of the page non-existent. We're really the basis of how the project will work in the end. And the stuff will find its way online in the near future as well. So, you know, we're part of the process, and they, you know, we send them the images off and hopefully they like them. And if it's not enough for something for them to fix, they have us do a retake. It's fairly straightforward and it seems to be working well enough.
For a historian, though, it must be really interesting, because one of the drawbacks or potential drawbacks of digitization of these these older resources is that, yes, we're able to save them, but you lose the specificity of them. So you might not realize when you find, you know, you do a search for a specific article and it pulls up this newspaper clipping from 1932 or 1912 that it was, you know, located on the front page versus on page A7. So, mm-hmm. you know, understanding where it fits in and the dynamics of that information in relation to the rest of the information in the actual resource.
Yeah, and an interesting thing about that is, you know, when you get the newspaper, it's numbered in a kind of a different way. You have to unwrap it and all that. And a lot of the ones we're working with, maybe 50, 60, 70 years ago, they were cut and bound to be like a regular book. So that process of them, you know, their special nature as a periodical had actually had already been changing throughout their lives. So, yeah, it's interesting how this shows a bit of an evolution of, you know, how people are starting to see, how people have been seeing all this data changing over time.
Well, that sounds really interesting. And so this is a temporary project, or it's probably a term project or something.
Yeah.
So it's going to be ending in summer?
Yeah, sometime in the summer. It depends how fast or slow we go. I mean, that's, you know, that's almost the running joke when you have a project.
Drag it out as long
as
you can.
I mean, you go. There is a date. A publisher for this wants this to be done. So, you know, we do our best. You know, the books can go by quickly because, you know, most of them have been cut. If they haven't, well, you know, we go to the collections person in the room with us and say, cut this for us. So it's okay. But yeah, I mean, some of them do take a while. I mean, I was doing one recently that wasn't a small publication from Maine, and then it wasn't individual issues, and that took a little longer, and the quality of those were just terrible. You know, they were basically falling apart, and the prior owner had literally chopped them all up. So there were whole parts missing. So that can slow you down. But yeah, I mean, the timing of this is can be quite variable, but you know, you got to get this done eventually.
Now, this is actually kind of probably irrelevant, but I'm just curious. Does this end up destroying the originals, or are you able to restore the originals and put them back on the show?
I try my best not to make it any worse than it already is. So this project is largely about just getting the digitized version out there without hurting the materials. I mean, it's already, a lot of them have been damaged to such a degree already. It's not much more you can do to them. But yeah, so with this project, we're not trying to. It was considered like years back for a digitization project elsewhere, and they were taking apart the book in that case. And I can kind of see why they do that sometimes, because when they bind the periodicals, a lot of the text sometimes gets a little too deep into the margins, and you can't get it scanned unless you literally take apart the book. But personally, I like to see digitization as a form of preservation. You get it on there without hurting the object much more than it's already been hurt, and then less people have to actually touch it later on. So there can be kind of a fine line depending on what the goals of the project are.
Okay. And now, since this is a term project that's going to end in the summer, so any idea what comes next for you?
Well, you know, I may do a little more at Fruitlands Museum, but, you know, I'm always, you know, looking for that curation job. You know, that's my career goal, you know, collections, exhibits. And so I'm always looking for more of that when I can get it. And, you know, whenever I can, I help out with the Western Museum. So there's, you know, there's planning as much as there can be the way, you know, the job market shifts around. But, you know, even, you know, all experience is good. You know, that's pretty much what a coworker of mine once said to me back when my archaeology days. It's all, every little thing gets on your resume, or at least your CV. And the things you can talk about later, like, you know, like now, and you can say you've done stuff, and then, you know, like I said, patience, and eventually, you know, eventually it all sort of helps out.
Great. Now, one last question, which you may or may not have an answer to, but is there anything you wish you had done differently along the way?
You know, it is hard to answer. You know, I graduated my undergrad in 2009, and so a lot of things like economics were way beyond my control. So in a lot of ways, I almost wish I could have found an online program a little sooner, because after 2008, you know, regular brick and mortar programs are pretty but shuttered, you know.
Right.
At the same time, I was still gaining experience in one form or another. So it's kind of hard to say, because, you know, there are a lot of factors beyond your control in this whole career.
Right. Okay. Well, that's good. Good to hear that you have no regrets, or at least no regrets that you want to share.
I do my best.
Okay.
I mean, but always listen to that constructive criticism. You know, it took me 4 years of undergrad to understand how good it is to handle constructive criticism, because it's hard to take sometimes, you know. People, you know, you think your work is great and someone else says, you know, I should learn English or something, you know. So all experience is good like that, you know. Enjoy the work, you know. There's a lot of something I learned in archaeology was that archaeology itself has a lot of little pleasures. You find the object, you can clean it, and then you can learn about it. And so that's something that can really transfer to, you know, to work in museums. You find an object to put into an exhibit, and you can enjoy finding out stuff about it, because it could be an object no one's actually even seen for 20 years. And so, you know, just enjoy yourself and just you know, work to find what's good in the project, even if it's a little grueling.
that's good advice.
Yeah.
All right, well, great. Thanks for joining us today, Jeff.
Thanks again.
Thank you.
And thank you, everybody, for joining us today. If you have any questions or comments on this podcast or suggestions for future episodes, as always, please send me an email at snhuhistory@gmail.com. For James Fennessy and Jeffrey Henry, I am Rob Denning. Until next time, have a good day.
Thanks for having me. This was interesting for me. I've been interviewed like this before.
Great.
It's usually a job interview, which is a little less, a little more nerve-wracking than a job interview.
Right. Yeah, this is about the lowest stakes you could possibly get.
Yeah.
But the most enjoyable.
Yes, okay.
Yeah.